Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carbon DeVito.
And we are Groundworks, Inc. We design, build gardens in New York City. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Our show brings the culture to horticulture.
If we don't say so ourselves.
So for today's horticultural honor roll, we have...
We have Arabidopsis thalia, an unassuming...
Say that three times fast.
Arabidopsis thalia. I had to really practice that pronunciation.
Arabidopsis I hope I got it right. Thalia.
An unassuming little plant native to Europe, Asia, and parts of Africa. If you found it in your garden, you'd probably rip it out. And we've selected it this week because it is a favorite subject for plant scientists, and it had the honor of being the first plant to have its entire genome sequenced. It happens to have a relatively small number of genes, making it a good subject for research. So I kind of think of it as a lab rat for the plant kingdom.
That's right.
Now, this plant was first described in 1577 in the Harz Mountains by Johann Thal.
Another German?
A German. A physician. Another German physician, of course. They seem to dominate the field of 16th and 17th century botany.
Philosophy.
Everything.
Botany.
It was their time. Well, he called it Pilosella siliquosa, which is even harder to pronounce. But in 1753, Carl Linnaeus renamed the plant Arabis thaliana in honor of Thal. In 1842, the German botanist Gustav Heinhold erected the new genus Arabidopsis and placed the plant in that genus. The genus name Arabidopsis comes from Greek, meaning resembling Arabis. So that is our plant, our horticultural honor roll this week. Thank you, Joe. So today we're going to go deep. We're going to go very deep. Today our show, we're going to kind of take the ubiquitous existential question that begins with, if a tree falls in the forest... And we're going to kind of turn the ending around. Here's what we want to know. If a tree falls in the forest, does it hear itself fall? Does it know that it's fallen? Does it send out for help?
Does it cry?
Does it feel pain? Our guest today, Professor Daniel Shamovitz, tackles these kinds of questions in his new book, What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses, which I think is a great, great title. A very, very abbreviated bio of Professor Shamovitz. He's the director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University. He is the author of numerous scholarly articles and has written for such diverse publications as the Wall Street Journal and the Daily Beast. He joins us from his home in Had HaSharon, Israel today. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon.
Hi, Danny.
What time is it there?
About 10:30.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us so late. We really appreciate you taking the time.
That was a great introduction to Arabidopsis. I didn't know half those things, by the way.
Oh, well, we're glad to share. We like esoteric botanical knowledge.
Yeah, and we do, every week we have a horticultural honor roll, and we, you know, shed light on some ubiquitous plant.
And also obscure botanists.
Yeah. You know?
Which so far have been mostly German physicians. For some reason, we have to delve into that to find out. Well, anyway, let's talk about your book. It was such an interesting read. And the second title, A Field Guide to the Senses, what I like about the sort of layout of the book is that you use science's understanding of our own senses as a sort of baseline for understanding plants' sensory capabilities. So I'm wondering if that had something to do with the impetus of the book.
Oh, it definitely did. Well, you know, you said that it was using human senses as a tie-in for plant senses, but from the same way, you could look at maybe that the book is using plant senses for helping us to understand our own senses more and maybe even start discussing what it really means to be a human.
That's what I got out of it.
Yeah.
In lightly skimming over it, because we just got it a couple of days ago, but Carmen read it more thoroughly, but I was really just taken back to my anatomy classes and my philosophy classes, actually, from college, and it was wonderful to think like that again.
Oh, well, then I guess I succeeded in what we were trying. You know, we had no way of knowing if we'd be managed to merge these two fields, human biology and plant biology, without becoming too touchy-feely, but I hope we succeeded somewhat.
No, you definitely did, and one of the things that I found remarkable to learn is just how very similar some of the systems were in both humans and plants. I don't think that, you know, people think about that. I mean, at the genomic level, many of the senses that we kind of think of as exclusively animal exists in plants, but in a kind of different way. Let's talk about one of the ones that I personally think is one of the most subjective, is sight, right? I mean, that is definitely, you know, plants don't have eyes. They don't have a central nervous system. What does a plant really see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when I use these words, what a plant, you know, sight or smell or feeling, you know, I'm being, you know, controversial here, and I realize that. But
yeah.
It made me start thinking for myself, you know, what is sight? You know, if you have so, I knew someone who was blind who, through some type of intervention, all of a sudden could tell the difference between light and dark. Of course, that person wasn't seeing in pictures. But for him, the difference between complete blackness and seeing shadows was definite type of vision, definitely sight.
Right.
So if we consider that that's sight for a person, then plants see at least as well, if not better, because, you know, plants have to see where their food is. Well, actually not where their food, or at least where their energy for their food is. So not only do plants sense where the light is, and you might see that in the flowers growing on your windowsill when they bend towards the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But they can also differentiate between colors. Plants can tell the difference, for example, between red and blue, and I think most people are quite freaked out to hear that.
Wow. Yeah, I did not know that plants could differentiate colors. I was really surprised to read that.
Right. Well, we're right.
I mean, here's an experiment you could do in your own garden. Take a flashlight, put red cellophane on one, put another flashlight with blue cellophane on the other, and put a plant between it and see which direction it bends, and it will always bend to the blue light, not to the red light.
Oh, the blue light.
Hey, that's going to be that's a good science experiment for my kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, there
you just gave me a great idea. Well, you know,
and actually, that was an experiment that was done by another German physician in the 19th century.
Okay. Wow, those guys really good.
Jules von Zach, yeah.
Nice. Well, a lot of it has to do with what you call rootedness, in that plants cannot escape their bad environment as a human can. We can run away from danger. We can, you know, run away from a bad environment.
And hunt for food.
Right. Yeah. And we can get out of the heat. We can, you know, we have mobility. So, you know, plants have had to develop a very sensitive and sensory mechanism.
Because plants are sessile, because they're really rooted, unmovable, they have to be incredibly sensory organisms. And they have to be able to adapt to a completely changing environment without the ability to escape from it.
Right, right.
So, you know, escaping or moving is a very easy evolutionary adaptation.
Right, so tell us, if you can tell our
from a plant's point of view, you know, if it's all of a sudden shaded by another plant, it can't just move to where the sun is. It has to figure out where the sun is and grow towards it. So it has to be able to see where the light's coming. If it's the temperature is changing, it has to be able to sense the change in temperature and change its own development so that it can survive severe cold or severe heat.
Right.
And if its neighbor is sick,
right,
for example, because it's been attacked by viruses or been attacked by caterpillars, it would really help it if it could smell this sick plant and itself adapt towards that.
Right. I liked your description of the parasitic daughter, you know, and how
that...
Could you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, so this is a daughter, or in Latin it's called cuscuta. It's a parasitic plant. It can't do photosynthesis. And the way it works is by attaching itself onto a neighboring plant and then sucking nutrients off it. It's a scourge to some forms of agriculture. And what the experiment that was done by a professor at Penn State University was, she put the cuscuta, or the daughter plant, next to a tomato plant. And through time-lapse photography, you could see that the daughter always grows towards the tomato. But now here comes the really funny experiment. If you put the daughter right in the middle between a wheat plant and a tomato plant, it'll always grow towards the tomato and not to the wheat.
Because
in
of the smell?
It has preferences.
Preferences,
and the
right.
way it finds the tomato is that it smells it. Mm-hmm. And the way she found that out was that she took a leaf from a tomato, basically made a perfume from the leaf, put that on some cotton, and then the daughter would just grow to the smell of the tomato leaf.
Wait, so how are they smelling? How are the plants smelling the other plants? How is that possible?
We're using this word smell, but they don't have a nose.
Right.
Right.
But at the molecular basis, they're smelling exactly the same way we smell. When you smell any type of smell, what's happening is that some type of chemical, which is what we call a volatile chemical, a chemical in the air, like if you open a bottle of vinegar, the vinegar smell comes through the air, goes into your nose. In your nose, there's a receptor that's specifically attuned for binding a small molecule of the vinegar smell, and then it sends a signal to your brain. The exact same thing is happening in the communication between plants when a leaf gives off a smell into the air. That smell goes to the neighboring plant, and it binds to receptors on the surface of its cells, just like we have receptors in the surface of the cells in our nose. It has receptors on its leaf cells that then tell it to do something, for example, grow towards the tomato, or tell it to ripen. Mm-hmm. Plants give off smells that tell other fruits to ripen.
Like ethylene, right? That was a classic.
Like ethylene,
right,
exactly. Yeah. You know, as plant people, you probably know that, if you put a banana and a ripe banana and a unripe avocado in the same bag,
right,
you make that avocado ripen much faster.
Right.
Because
ripe
fruit gives off a gas, ethylene, and the unripe fruits smell it.
Mm-hmm.
They absorb the gas.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start signaling their own ripening.
Mm-hmm.
And daughter's not the only plant that can smell things. Obviously, there's many others. In the book, you talked about some experiments with damaged plants and how they had eavesdropping neighbor plants that picked up on the fact that the plants were damaged.
We're touching on the question, do plants talk to each other?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Communication,
yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So the finding was that if you have a tree that was attacked by caterpillars, neighboring trees would often be resistant to those same caterpillars.
So why?
And what
they
found out was that the attack tree, when the leaves were eaten by the caterpillars, they gave off a gas into the air that was then picked up by the neighboring tree, and then they start making chemicals that are toxic for the caterpillars so that they don't eat them.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Now, when this research was first published, there was a huge outcry. Wow, plants are talking to each other. The trees are talking. They're screaming, help me, save me, watch out.
Right.
Yeah, but then you start have to asking the question, sometimes we can do a little bit too much anthropomorphism.
Right.
Is it that one tree is yelling to another tree, watch out, which we can really interpret in beautiful terms?
Right.
Or could it be one branch of one tree is signaling to its sister branch, watch out, because, it's trying to save itself.
Right.
But when you release a gas into the air, it's not unidirectional, it goes all around. And the neighboring tree just picks this up. And so it's sort of like eavesdropping.
Yeah.
Or as one of my colleagues wrote in an article, maybe it's just passing gas and the other one's smelling it.
Ba-dum-bum. Right.
Except when humans do it, isn't helping us.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. No, it's really brilliant. And, it is a very existential topic because, you kind of start to think of good and evil then,
And we have to be very careful not to do that. And one of the problems in writing the book was how to maintain the anthropomorphic language while at the same time remembering that the experience is completely different for a plant.
Exactly, right.
There is no emotion involved here.
Right.
This isn't some type of soap opera drama going on around us.
But there could be.
That's our own interpretation of what we're seeing.
Right.
Right. There was a book that you mentioned, a book that was written in the 1970s. I forget.
The Secret Life of
Plants. Yes, I have that book.
Yeah.
And this is not The Secret Life of Plants. I have that book, and this is very different from that.
Yeah. We have to take
a... The Secret Life of Plants, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because as I've been teaching for the past 17 years, I'm always asked several times during a semester, you know, I once read in a book, The Secret Life of Plants, that plants know when you're lying to them.
Yeah. And the whole music thing.
That book got a huge amount of press, a huge amount of popularity, even though it's completely based on pseudoscience.
Yeah. And Danny, hang on the line, because when we come back, I want to talk about music and plants.
Yes.
There's that myth.
Okay, sure, great.
You know, hang on one second. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to This One by Snow Mine on the Heritage Radio Network.org. I let loose a storm and watch it fall down. No matter where it lies, but only where I am. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today we have a really fun guest, Danny Chamovitz from Tel Aviv, calling in. He's from the University of Tel Aviv, and we're talking about plants and what a plant knows, a field guide to the senses. Before the break, we were talking about the effect, the kind of myth effect of music and plants and how music affects plants. Danny, can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, sure.
Can plants hear?
many people are, you know, surprised to find out that plants see, can sense light, and they're shocked to find out that plants smell. Many are convinced that plants not only hear, but have musical taste.
Right.
And a lot of this is because of that book, The Secret Life of Plants. But through, you know, 70, 80, over 100 years of research, there's no credible results showing that plants actually have any type of auditory prowess. Actually, one of the first people to do experiments on that was Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. He played the bassoon because he was a bassoonist to his plants, and they didn't care. And actually, in the few things that have been published, there's something interesting you can find, is that the plants always thrive in the music that the person doing the experiment prefers himself.
Exactly, exactly. So it's subjective. It's completely a subjective.
There's a bias there somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think these people are out to fool us.
No.
But it could be that, you know, when you're listening to music that you like, you're a better gardener.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay, so we know plants can see, they can smell.
They can communicate.
And they can kind of communicate with each other. You can't hear, but in chapter 5, I found this really...
Can I add one thing in here?
Sure.
I don't want to say that plants don't hear.
Okay.
As a scientist, what I can say is that there's no evidence
correct
that shows that plants respond to sound waves.
Okay, I agreed.
But
leave it at that.
It could be that plants actually are responding to, like, the ultrasonic sound of a bug's wing that we don't even hear.
Yeah, that's true.
We just haven't done the right experiment yet. Mm-hmm.
That's true. We'll keep it open-ended. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So let's talk about the sixth sense, which I think you call proprioception.
Proprioception or equiperception.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the way that we know when we're standing up or lying down, or what allows you to scratch the back of your head, or hopefully to touch your nose if you're not drunk.
Yeah, that science is amazing. When you described the physical mechanism of how we know that we're upright mm-hmm. was amazing. And plants kind of have a similar system, right, in place.
Yeah, right, because if you take your plants and you put their pot on the side, the shoots will always grow up and the roots will always grow down. And this is the same whether it's in a well-lit room or in a completely dark room. It's not a response to the light. It's a response to gravity.
Okay.
And how do they tell that there's gravity?
What happens, and what happens in humans is that in our inner ear, we have these crystals that are floating around, and that's what makes us dizzy when we're going in circles, and that's how we know when we're upright or upside down. It ends up that plants, for example, in their root tips, have something very similar to these crystals. It's not the exact same thing. These are bodies of starch, which fall to the bottom of the plant cell, and that tells the root that's the direction of gravity. So when you place it on its side, those starch granules fall to the bottom of the cell, and then the cells start growing. The roots start growing down.
Isn't it extraordinary? What I found amazing.
And of course, then, if you put a plant up in the space station, they're cool, very cool experiments. These things sort of just like are all round in the cell, and the plant has no idea where up or where down is.
Right, right.
So when those starches are in the right position, that's how it knows where gravity is.
That's how it knows where up is,
where
and
up
that's
is
how it knows
down.
Where down is.
Yeah, I was imagining in my inner ear a like level like thing. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Almost the bubble that's in a
mm-hmm.
level.
Yeah.
And when that is right, then I'm, you know, I'm
then you're
upright.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And when it's not right.
So Danny, do you think plants
that's exactly what it is, basically.
Yeah.
So do you think plants,
but it's just that you got these crystals in these like little rocks that help make it much more sensitive.
That's what I'm going to say to the police. Right now, when I get pulled over, I'm going to say right now, my starches are off balance. This is why I can't touch my nose. I'm really going to explain it to you. I've got a defense.
And he's going to say, ma'am, put your arms behind your back and get in the back of the car.
Exactly. I don't know what kind of defense
from Danny, from my anatomy and physiology class, I remember this word, you know, like it just stuck with me. Homeostasis. Do plants have homeostasis?
Uh-huh. Of course.
Yeah.
All of it. Homeostasis is our ability to maintain equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in light of a changing environment,
mm-hmm.
and that's why plants are such sensory organisms in order to maintain homeostasis, so that they can really maintain their equilibrium in a completely changing environment. I mean, imagine how you would survive, you know, if like I would pour like cement in your studio right now,
mm-hmm.
and you guys couldn't leave for the next 12 months, and you'd have to go through both winter and summer, and, you know, just think of all the major problems you would have if you were just cemented there.
Right.
You would have major problems with
yeah. yeah.
Ma'am, put your arms behind your back. And so, let's talk about there's all these capabilities that plants have, and then there's all these capabilities, of course, that humans have. Let's talk about the adaptation of how the similarities exist. Let's get into the existential side of it.
Well, I think, you know, many people, I don't want to say we, let's say many people, like to think that humans are like the end all of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we are the most advanced. And to come to the conclusion that we are just one evolutionary outcome is a little scary for us. But if you think with an open mind, all organisms, whether it be people, whether it be cows, whether it be chrysanthemums, or even bacteria or yeast, need to be able to interact with their environment in order to survive. You know,
right.
You have to be able to find your optimum place within the ocean. And so there are bacteria or algae that know how to swim up and down to find the exact correct light. So even early in evolution, the ability to sense evolved. So it's not surprising that all organisms have different types of rudimentary senses. And since we all evolved from the same single-celled organisms, it shouldn't be surprising at all that at the genetic level, the remnants of these early sensory mechanisms are present both in plants and in animals. For example, the ability to see blue light. One of the reasons we as humans need to see blue light is to reset our circadian rhythms, mm-hmm. our daily clocks. You know, when you get on jet lag, if you fly halfway across the the world, you're told to go out into the light to help mm-hmm. reset the clock.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The same basic mechanism of blue light resetting the clock also exists in plants. So this is another way of seeing. It's not seeing in pictures, but it's seeing the light and having an effect on our own metabolism.
Right, and that would be vitamin D, right?
Well, it then goes through vitamin D, but the receptor itself is a protein called cryptochrome. We could go all through the biology, but it's a blue light receptor found both in humans and plants and in yeast.
Okay.
And it's a blue light receptor that is sensitive to the blue light signal, and then it signals to the body what to do with it afterwards.
Okay.
And what I find interesting, too, is that all these adaptations and all these senses that are being used and the information coming in, the plants are not just like remembering it for themselves, things like stress and reacting, but they also seem to be able to pass that information on to their offspring. What I read and towards the end of your book was that stressed parent plants can give rise to offspring that grew better under harsh conditions than the regular plants. How does that work?
Isn't that the truth?
I know it's probably true for humans.
You've come across probably the most surprising thing.
Yeah. Right.
Is that plants remember.
Yeah. Right.
You know, if we can accept the fact that plants can maybe see, smell, know when you're touching them, memory has to be something that's only human, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was really surprising.
Plants can remember past occurrences, like when the last time they saw a particular light color was, if someone touched them, or if there was a virus in the area, and then recall that information later. They can remember it. And not only do they remember it, they can pass on that memory to the next generation. I hope this isn't too scary. This is actually not particular to plants. It's also in humans and other animals, we now know.
Right.
It's a whole paradigm shift in genetics, which is called epigenetics.
Wow.
Where we now know that, for example, humans who go through different types of stresses, mothers who are stressed or what can pass on characteristics to their children that are not based in particular genes, but based in the structure of the DNA. It's not causing a mutation, but it's causing the DNA itself to change, and that's what's being passed on.
Wow.
And it's called transgenerational memory.
Transgenerational memory.
Wow.
Memory.
And it's across.
So, for example, a plant that's been through drought, quite often its offspring will be resistant to drought.
Mm-hmm.
And that can go on for at least two or three generations.
So what do you think is going to happen in 100 years with plants?
Well, I'm actually not so, we talk about global warming.
Right.
We talk about changing the environment. The plants will survive because plants will adapt.
Uh-huh.
The question is, will we be able to? I mean, the question is, will the plants that we use for agriculture survive and adapt?
Right.
But plants will continue to adapt. They will continue to survive. They will continue to find the right environment to live in. But it's not clear that the plants that we need to survive will be the ones that are surviving.
Right.
And that's, I think, why it's so important that everyone have a better understanding of plant biology, because, 50 years from now, when the population of the world, 35 years from now, when the population of the world reaches 9 billion people,
mm-hmm.
which is three times more than the year that I was born,
mm-hmm.
We're going to have to make a lot of food.
That's what I was just
thinking.
If we
don't understand
right.
how plants adapt to their own environment, we won't be able to grow enough food with dwindling resources to provide for our own needs.
Right, and variety.
That's plant, like you said, right. The plants will be fine. They've right. been around for a long time, and they'll continue to be.
Right.
So. Exactly.
Well, your book.
But, are they the ones that you're going to want to be eating? That's a completely different question.
Exactly. That's why I mentioned variety.
Arabidopsis, you're not going to get too far with.
No, we're not. Well, I think I read somewhere somebody said humans. The human species seems to be the only one that goes against its natural instincts.
Right.
You know. So I hope that
could be the subject for a whole another interview, probably.
Exactly. So, well, I think your book goes a long way to helping people understand the importance of plants. And our relationship and how very close we are genetically to them. I don't think I can look at a tomato, an Arabidopsis, or any other plant in quite the same way again.
Yeah. And you're...
Yeah, but I hope you're not afraid to eat them still. You know,
no.
One of the people who read my book said, oh my God, now my daughter won't have anything left to eat. You know, the fact that plants have senses doesn't mean that we shouldn't eat them. They're actually, you know, they want to be eaten. That's how their seeds are passed on.
Right.
And while plants know many things, there's no pain involved. There's no sentience involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no thinking involved. So, you know, go away and cut, you know, keep going on and pruning your plants and eating your plants. There's no ethics here.
Well, I wish I was in Tel Aviv and I could take your class because you've...
Well, you can.
Yeah, I could.
Actually, starting tomorrow...
Yes.
I'm giving a class through Coursera called What a Plant Knows, which so far 31,000 people have registered for.
That's fantastic.
So
actually, tomorrow goes live, the first lecture of What a Plant Knows. You can find it on the internet, and it's free for anyone who wants to take it.
Great. What time is that? Well, I'll look it up.
Because it's on the internet. You can do it whenever you want. It'll be live from 1 in the morning tomorrow.
Okay.
And you can log on anytime you want during the week and take lecture number one. And then next week, so this lecture is the introduction, and next week we'll be talking about what a plant sees.
Okay, and how do we find out, what's the website? Whataplantknows.com?
Well, it's on one of those new MOOC websites. It's called Coursera.org.
Okay.
Coursera.org.
Okay.
And if you just look up What a Plant Knows on Google, it pops up.
Okay. Well, fascinating. I'm going to tune in, and it's been delightful talking with you, and thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to me also.
For all of your research. It's fascinating, fascinating
work.
Take
the course, read the book, What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses by Daniel Shamovitz. Thank you so much for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio
Network.
Thank
you, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Get some sleep.
The show has been produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Joe G. Remember to join our Facebook fan page to stay current on our projects, be aware, find out about upcoming shows, and also to win some free stuff. Thanks for listening.
We dig plants. Thank you.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.